All right. Good afternoon or good morning, depending on what part of the country you are participating from. I'd like to welcome everybody to the legal issues webinar session today. As you all know, we have our speaker, Barry Taylor, who's the Director of Legal Services, and Alan Goldstein is the Senior Attorney at Equip for Equality. Today we'll be addressing the top 10 ADA cases for the year, last year, 2010, amazing how time flew. But before we get started, I just want to go over a couple of things and remind anybody that has a group participating, if they can or need closed captioning, we have captioning available at this time. You can click on the CC icon found at the top to turn on the captioning, or you can use the keystroke command control F8. The screen is a pop-up screen for the captioning, and you can adjust the size and move it around anywhere that works with your screen and your preference. Also, we have the chat area where you can submit questions in the chat box. The keystroke command to access that is Control M. During the session, we're going to close it, and we're asking participants to please hold off on questions till the question and answer time that we have allotted. And until then, make a note, I suggest, keep a paper so it doesn't slip your mind, and jot them down the side, and we'll get to those at the end of the hour, or Barry and Alan will instruct you if we take a break in the middle of the session for questions. The other item I'd like to point out is the emoticons, or the little signals to identify gestures. Those are a little bit distracting to the presenters at times and other participants, and so we are asking that you do not click on those during the session as well. Without any further ado, I don't have any more housekeeping issues. I will pass it over to Barry and Alan, who will bring up the top 10 cases for 2010. Thank you.
Hi, this is Alan Goldstein, and I'm going to be doing the first half of the presentation with Barry doing the second half. And before we start, we just want to thank our staff attorney, Lauren Lowe, who was a great help in helping us put together the top 10 list, top 10 ADA cases of 2010. We haven't done something like this before, and it's actually, I think what's fun, because often what we do is we pick out certain issues from a case, a direct threat issue or an accommodation issue, but doing it this way, we're able to really look at a case holistically and discuss the whole case. I'm on slide number 4 now, and you can see in the overview, we have the cases listed that we're going to discuss. We have 6 cases under Title I, because there is a lot more litigation under Title I than under Titles II and III. And then we also have 2 cases under Title II and 2 under Title III. And to give you maximum value for your free webinar dollar, we've also included a few other recent cases that might have issues similar to the 10 cases we're discussing. And then in addition to the top 10, we also have in the right-hand corner a Top Gun picture of Tom Cruise. So we're really trying to make it an all-inclusive webinar. For Illinois attorneys, on to the next slide, you can see that Illinois attorneys are eligible for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit, and we'll repeat this slide later. An interested attorney should contact Barry Taylor at barryt@equipforequality.org. So we're going to move into Title I, the top 10 ADA cases for 2010. We have Horkin v. Simmons, Harrison v. Benchmark Electronics, Lowe v. Independent School District, Livingston v. Fred Meyer Stores, Gratzel v. the Office of the Chief Judges, and Sawatka v. Rockwell. So moving on to the next slide now, which starts with Horkin v. Simmons, which looks at disability and the definition of disability under the ADA Amendments Act, which, as I'm sure most of you know, went into effect January 1st of 2009. In the Horkin case, one procedural issue. The Horkin case was decided on what's called a motion to dismiss. And essentially in that kind of situation, the defendant employer is saying that the plaintiff's complaint, and just looking at the complaint, with maybe limited outside evidence. The complaint doesn't really state a claim to which relief can be granted, even if everything in the complaint is true. A lot of our other cases are not on motions to dismiss. They're on what's called a motion for summary judgment, which is done in a case after the parties engage in what's called discovery, which is an exchange of information. And on a motion for summary judgment, you're saying, looking at all this information, there are no questions of material disputed facts left to decide. I think it's generally a higher standard for defendants, employers to meet on a motion to dismiss, just to say there's no claim whatsoever based on the complaint, that there's no claim whatsoever that the plaintiff can prove. And that's the status of the Horgan case. Plaintiff was an employee with HIV who was terminated after disclosing his HIV status. And then the defendant challenged that on a motion to dismiss. In this case, the complaint alleged that the supervisor demanded to know if there was something medical going on with the employee. And the employee said under this constant barrage of questions, he felt, quote, compelled, unquote, to disclose that he was HIV positive. He told his supervisor that his condition was under control and did not interfere with his job performance. And in fact, he had always exceeded expectations. The employer went on to say, how can you perform the job, quote, with a terminal illness, unquote? How can you lead coworkers once they learn of the condition? And I assume the supervisor wasn't aware that medical conditions are supposed to be kept confidential under the ADA. And then the supervisor told the employee, you need to recover, you should go on vacation and leave the plant immediately. And the next day, they terminated his employment. So the employee claimed that he was unlawfully terminated and that the employer engaged in unlawful medical inquiries. The next slide shows what the court said on the issue of whether Mr. Horgan was covered under the ADA as amended. The court noted that the Amendments Act lists functions of the immune system as major life activities and also looked at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, notice of proposed rulemaking, NPRM, and said that in the NPRM it states that HIV consistently meets the definition of disability. It further quoted a lot from the purposes and findings of the Amendments Act, saying that disability inquiry should not demand extensive analysis. And the court concluded that Mr. Horgan, based on his HIV status, did indeed have a disability under the ADA as amended. Looking on to the next issue, did the employer engage in an improper medical inquiry by asking him to disclose the condition? The court noted that the ADA prohibits inquiry as to the existence or as to the nature or severity of a disability unless the employer can show that the inquiry is job-related and consistent with business necessity. In this case, the employer asked about his medical conditions. He asked about his T-cell count and asked what would happen if your T-cell count went under 200 and a lot of invasive questions like that. The employer claimed that they were entitled to ask questions once they learned of the employee's HIV status. But the court says that's not necessarily true. In this case, the employee stated that the condition did not affect his performance. There was no evidence that he had poor performance. So therefore, the questioning was not job-related or consistent with business necessity. In this case, the supervisor went further and advised the employee that he should tell his family about his status, et cetera, et cetera. On to the next slide, there was one other claim in addition to the disability issue and the medical inquiry issue. Mr. Horgan also raised a state law claim of it for invasion of privacy under Illinois law. And the court held that even though the inquiry violated the ADA, it was not a sufficient prying into a zone of solitude to establish a claim for invasion of privacy. One thing, we have a couple of notes here. One, states may also have an AIDS or HIV Confidentiality Act, which might apply in such situations. Illinois has one. And I just want to note that almost every case we've seen interpreting the ADA Amendments Act have been very deferential to the congressional findings and purpose and have almost uniformly found disability. And then a little bit of a bonus case is the Hoffman case, also from 2010, where the court looked at the Amendments Act and the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking and said that cancer in remission may be a disability if it would substantially limit a major life activity when active. And then we have the Gill versus Vortex case, which was an employee with monocular vision. And the court, again, noted that under the Amendments Act, he did have a substantial limitation of a major life activity. The court noted that prior to the Amendments Act, this person may not have been deemed to have a disability under the ADA. And the individual also had a regarded as claim. As the employer said, we're not going to hire you due to the fear of injury. One thing we can do with our new webinar system is we can ask everyone to vote on some questions. So we have some queries here. And in this one it says, under the ADA Amendments Act, should all claims except for a failure to accommodate proceed under a regarded as prong? So if someone's alleging wrongful termination or failure to hire, should they say, I'm a person with a current disability? Or should they just say the employer regarded me as having a disability? So I hope that's clearly stated. You can vote yes or no in the participant box. In the lower right-hand corner, you'll see a green check mark and a red cross. So if you think employees should, under the old ADA, employees would use all three prongs just to be safe because it was so hard to prove disability. The Amendments Act very strongly revised the definition of disability and particularly the regarded as prong. And so I've heard some people say that really everything except a failure to accommodate has its best chance as a regarded as type of case. And I just want to hear what people think or see what people think. So please check the check or please mark the check mark or the cross in your participants box whether you think people should look to the regarded as prong for every claim that's not a failure to accommodate or whether it still makes sense to use I have a current disability or a record of disability type of claim. Okay, I think we have a fair number of voting, so I'm going to tally them up. And you should be able to see in the middle of the screen that 30% thought no, 16% yes, and 53% didn't quite respond. And I know it's a bit of a tricky question, but I've actually been on a panel with an EEOC commissioner and said that under the ADA's amended, because the regarded as prong is now so strong, you don't have to show an actual disability, that she feels every claim except a failure to accommodate has its best chance for success under the regarded as prong. Of course, under the Amendments Act, there are no accommodations for people who are regarded as having a disability, so that's why you would not use regarded as in a failure to accommodate case. Okay, thank you for your participation. On to the next slide, talking about Harrison versus Benchmark Electronics in Huntsville, which involved the standing, do you have to be a person with a disability to raise an improper medical inquiry claim? And also, what is the nature of a medical inquiry? I have a picture of Fab 4 George Harrison in the right corner. He's not the person involved in the case. He was sued for stealing My Sweet Lord, but that's a whole other issue. So I just went with the name recognition and because I'm a bit of a Beatles fan. So in Harrison, Mr. Harrison alleged that he was subject to an improper medical inquiry as a job applicant. In this case, he was working as a contractor and then applied for a permanent job at his supervisor's request. Because of that status, both parties looked at it as if he was a job applicant because he was now applying for a permanent job. The company gave drug tests to all new applicants, and Mr. Harrison's came back positive for barbiturates. And drug tests under the ADA, according to EEOC guidance, are not considered medical examinations. So it was not an improper medical examination, but the question is, what about the medical inquiry that followed the drug test? And so what happened is the medical office called and asked him to explain, and he had a conversation with the medical office with his supervisor sitting in the room. And with the supervisor listening, he explained to the medical office that he had epilepsy. He has had it since he was, or had had it since he was 2 years old. He was prescribed barbiturates to help him be seizure-free, and it's been effective. And in fact, he was working as a temporary contractor and had no issues at work, which is why they wanted to hire him permanently. After the conversation, the medical office was satisfied with the explanation, felt he'd be able to do the job, But the supervisor, who originally is the one who recommended for him for the job, now says, no, I don't want to hire him. I think he has performance problems. He has attitude problems. Another coworker complained to him. And all of a sudden, after recommending him for the job, now had all these reasons why he should not be hired. It's interesting to note the EEOC found no disability and dismissed his claim, and this is prior to the ADA Amendments Act, and before the Amendments Act, it was very difficult for people with epilepsy to show that they were a person with a disability under the ADA. The next slide has the issues in the case with a much younger George Harrison in the upper right-hand corner. And the issues are, must a job applicant have a disability to challenge the lawfulness of a medical inquiry? And issue two, what type of inquiry is proper following a positive drug test? So if the drug test is not a medical exam, but it gives information that there are controlled substances in the person's system, what type of medical inquiry is then proper to follow up? And the appellate court reversed a grant of summary judgment for the employer, and they found that applicants without a disability may indeed challenge improper medical inquiries. And they looked at the language of the statute and noticed that the section dealing with improper medical inquiries referred to a job applicant, while the other sections referred to qualified individuals with disabilities. So clearly, the other sections, you needed to be an individual with a disability, but the fact that job applicant was used for the medical inquiry section meant to the court that Congress meant that any job applicant can challenge a medical inquiry whether they have a disability or not. And there's a note there that the majority of courts do follow this view. You do not need to have a disability to challenge an improper medical inquiry. And this case was also interesting because the complaint never really listed an improper medical inquiry as a grounds, although it did discuss the conversation he had with the medical office with the supervisor in the room. And the court said under the liberal federal pleading standards, there was still enough in the complaint to challenge the medical inquiry, even though it was not specifically listed as a cause of action. And the next slide, now we have the long-haired and bearded George Harrison. He had a lot of looks in his day. The next slide, we see what the court said. The court said regarding the inquiry, employers can only get limited information when asking applicants about prescription drug use due to drug testing. The court mentioned the EEOC guidance and regulations make it clear that the disability-related inquiries and questions are still prohibited. The medical office may have improperly asked about the epilepsy and seizures. It did say the employer may follow up on positive tests. An employer doesn't have to do nothing if a test comes back positive. They can ask if the drug's legally prescribed, but not about the underlying condition. And the court also noted that the supervisor's presence during the conversation with the medical office may have been an improper attempt to learn or elicit disability information. And the next slide has the EEOC enforcement guidance that the court relied on. And the EEOC says, quote, an employer may ask about lawful drug use or possible explanations for the positive result and has some sample questions. What medications have you taken that might have resulted in this positive test result? And are you taking this medication under a lawful prescription? Presumably, if you answer what medications you're taking and you say it's under a lawful prescription, that should end the inquiry according to the EEOC. We have a site there with a link for the EEOC enforcement guidance on disability-related inquiries and medical examinations. And I also have a note, as I mentioned before, drug tests, are not considered medical examinations under the ADA. In a couple of cases from the last year that had similar issues on drug testing, we have Bates versus Dura Automotive Systems, where a plant felt that there were more accidents, or a company felt there were more accidents at one of its plants, and it decided to start testing employees at that plant. And it tested for 12 drugs, including 3 Xanax, Lortab, and oxycodone. The Xanax is a non-narcotic used for anxiety and panic conditions. Lortab is a narcotic used for short-term pain, and oxycodone is a narcotic used for moderate and severe pain. And the employees who challenged this were found to have those drugs in their system. They submitted doctor's letters saying the drugs did not affect their performance, but the employer wouldn't consider those. The employer did give the employees an opportunity to transition to drugs without the prohibited substances. The employees refused and were terminated. And that brings up one caveat. I think it's always a bit of a tricky position and sometimes dangerous for employers to start getting involved with employee treatment and to say you should try different drugs instead of the drugs you're on. Medical decisions are really should be made between the person and their doctor. You might be able to suggest they might want to talk to their doctor about something that might be different if there are legitimate workplace issues, but employers should be very careful in recommending that employees change their medication. However, this case didn't involve an improper medical inquiry like the previous case. It involved the selection criteria. The plaintiffs alleged that the selection criteria excluded them because it excluded anyone who had those drugs in their system. And again, the court looked at the language and noted that the selection criteria statute says that only qualified individuals with disabilities may challenge improper selection criteria. Therefore, a person needs to have an actual disability to challenge it, unlike in the prior case where you did not need to have a disability to challenge an improper medical inquiry. So in this case, the plaintiffs who were found not to have disabilities did not have standing to challenge the improper selection criteria. And I have a query then, and this is another chance for you to vote in the participants box. Would this case have been decided differently under the ADA Amendments Act? This was a pre-Amendments Act case where the people were found not to have a disability. Do you think people would have had a disability under the Amendments Act? So you can either click on the green arrow or the red X in the participants box, or you can do Control and 1 for yes, or Control and 2 for no. So let's take a second and let people vote on this. Do you think the ADA Amendments Act, where they have found that people had disabilities and therefore could challenge the allegedly improper selection criteria? All right, everyone voted who wants to vote. Let's take a quick look at the tally. In this one, 36% said it would be different under the ADA Amendments Act, 13% said it would not, and I have to agree with the 36%. I think these people, because under the Amendments Act, you look at a person in their unmitigated, unmedicated state to see if they have a disability, which wasn't the case before, I think it would have been likely that these employees had a disability. I realize you didn't have a lot of facts to make that determination. But what I'm hearing a lot is under the Amendments Act, it's probably safer for employers to assume a person is covered. And then we have one more question for everyone. Would the company's actions hold up to a direct threat analysis? So the question is, if the employer thought the drugs were a direct threat, were they proper to say people using Xanax or Lortab or oxycodone could not work at that plant? Would those drugs in your system alone pose a direct threat? So vote yes if you think just having that drug in your system is enough to show direct threat, or vote no if you think the employer would have to show more than just the presence of that drug or those drugs in their system. All right. Oh, boy, it looks like almost everyone voted no, and I think you're right. We have 58% voting no, but really out of the 61 people who voted, 58 out of the 61 voted no. And that's true. I don't know if it would have held up to a direct threat analysis because you have to do an individualized assessment. You have to look at reasonable accommodations. And I think these blanket policies, if you have this drug, you cannot do this job, unless there's some federal Department of Transportation-like regulation also saying the same thing. I think employers are best if they do that individualized assessment and not have blanket policies. Next slide, Lowe versus Independent School. In this case, school district number one, in this case, a school planned to reassign a counselor with post-polio syndrome who used leg braces to teach in a cramped lab. She requested a larger room but didn't get a response for almost 4 months. And then finally, 2 weeks before school started, the school said, okay, let's hold a meeting. At the meeting, the teacher was told, no, there's no accommodations, and the superintendent admitted he wasn't prepared for the meeting, didn't even look at her list of proposed accommodations, didn't even know that all the science classes were science labs. He thought they could put her in a non-lab class. And after being told that there would not be accommodations, and there was some dispute exactly what was said, but that seemed to be the gist of the meeting, the teacher resigned, saying I wasn't accommodated, and that created a work environment I was constructively discharged. By not being accommodated, I just couldn't continue in the workplace anymore. Sorry, I jumped ahead a little bit. And then the next slide. The district court in this case, the lower court, found for the employer, saying when the teacher resigned before classes started, we don't know if they would have accommodated. The school might have done it at the last minute. So she broke down the interactive process by resigning. And the issue on summary judgment before the appellate court was, would Lowe have been accommodated had she not resigned in a huff, as the district court said? If she doesn't want to resign in a huff, she can resign in a minute and a huff. No, I'm sorry, that's an old Marx Brothers joke. And the appellate court looked at the same issue and overruled, reversed the district court denying summary judgment for the employer. The court felt its delay and lack of preparation showed a lack of good faith. A question of fact as to whether an employer has failed to interact in good faith will preclude summary judgment for the employer. And the court felt that Ms. Lowe could have reasonably concluded that she was not going to be accommodated and was going to have to teach in a small, crowded classroom. The court said the school is required to proceed in a reasonably interactive manner once receiving an accommodation request, and neither party can create or destroy liability by causing a breakdown of the interactive process. An employee still has to show that even if the employer is responsible for breaking down the interactive process, that there was still some accommodation they would have discovered had the process gone ahead. The court concluded that a constructive discharge may be shown by a failure to accommodate when an employer unlawfully creates working conditions so intolerable that a reasonable person in the employee's position would feel forced to resign, which is an objective standard. Next slide. There's also a concurrence, meaning an opinion that agreed with the decision, although maybe not the reasoning. The court said, well, her resignation may have short-circuited the process, so they didn't really have a chance to make the reasonable accommodation. And as the court noted, what the employer said, that it's not uncommon to make assignment changes shortly before school starts. And the concurrence also said you cannot base a reasonable accommodation claim solely on the allegation that an employer failed to engage in an interactive process. You also have to show there was an accommodation that would have resulted. The interactive process is not a means. It's not an end in itself. And as the court noted, an employer can totally refuse to engage in an interactive process, but if it accommodates the employee, then there's no violation of the ADA. And this is the position that a majority of courts agree with. And the concurrence, even though his reasoning was different, he agreed with the court because he felt the record didn't really show whether she would have been accommodated had she not resigned. Next slide, some similar cases to Lowe. There's Richardson, where an employee did deposition said, I need to be able to do everything. And the court said there was no violation for failing to engage in the interactive process because there was no reasonable accommodation that could have been discovered. The employee wanted non-essential job functions reassigned or deleted, which is not reasonable. And the court noted that they give substantial weight to the employer's view of job requirements. And also the Kibbers case is at the bottom of this slide, where it said working at home would not be reasonable because the employee would be unable to perform essential job functions or providing technical support, attending meetings and trainings, and achieving effective working relationships. So I jumped ahead a little bit. Oh, we have a couple more reasonable accommodation cases. Page also, that telework was not reasonable for a librarian who had multiple chemical sensitivity, an issue that we're seeing more of because being physically present was an essential function. And the Turner case, which was interesting because an employee alleged that he was fired for being naked in common areas, and he said, oh, I have to. I have psoriasis. My underwear becomes uncomfortable. I have to change my clothes wherever I am. And the court said, no, the company does not have to modify its no nakedness policy. I assume that was an unwritten policy at the time, but it was still an essential function to stay clothed in common areas. So the question I have, in Lowe, did the teacher break down the process, interactive process, by resigning, or should she have tried the new classroom at least for a day or a week before resigning? Here she just said, I'm not even going to try it, this isn't going to work, forget it. So my question is, I'm not sure whether, I'm asking if it's legally required, I'm really wondering, do you think she should have tried it anyway before resigning? So let's do a quick vote, control 1 for yes, control 2 for no, or click the green check or the red cross. And I'm going to do a quick tally. And it looks like most of the people said yes. And I think I agree with that. Even though the court said she was, her rights were still violated, employers only have to give an effective accommodation, not the one agreed upon. And here they weren't really giving much of anything. But sometimes it's best for an employee to try something, because if it doesn't work, then they have evidence of the problems caused by the lack of an accommodation or an alternative accommodation. Next slide is Livingston versus Fred Meyer Stores, which was a wine steward with a vision impairment who could not walk or drive safely after dark, and we requested a modified schedule to minimize night driving during the fall and winter. And the issue about accommodations for commuting limitations is one where there's a split in the circuits, as I'll discuss at the end. The employer actually gave this accommodation for a year. There was no problem, no hardship, but then the second year just decided they didn't want to do it again without any reason giving. And in fact, the plaintiff's wine sales increased when she had the accommodation. Livingston refused to work her unmodified scheduled shift and was fired, and the issue is, does the employer have an obligation to provide a reasonable accommodation for commuting issues related to disability? And the next slide shows that the court reversed summary judgment for the employer. One, they said Ms. Livingston did have a disability. Seeing is a major life activity, and she's limited in driving, walking, or leaving her house alone at night. They considered that substantial. And the Ninth Circuit has a rule regarding commuting issues that employers have a duty to accommodate an employee's disability-related limitations in getting to and from work. This might include making reasonable shift changes in accommodation, and her visual impairment didn't impact her performance at work, but it affected her ability to finish her shift, which triggered her duty to accommodate. So they're saying it's not really an external type of barrier she's facing. She couldn't finish her shift because she'd be unable or it'd be difficult for her to go home at the end of her shift. So they're saying it actually is a workplace issue, not extrinsic to the workplace. They found it significant that there was no hardship experienced by the employer or that her wine sales actually increased with her modified schedule. And the next slide, the court said that under the Supreme Court decision in Barnett, failing to engage in the interactive process results in employer liability when a reasonable accommodation would have otherwise been possible. I mentioned that point before, you need that second part. Fred Meyer's denied her request without any meaningful dialogue or explanation, and the fact that they merely requested additional information was not enough to show a good faith interaction in the interactive process. And then there's also an issue about motivating factor. In this case, the court said Livingston must show that her disability was a motivating factor in the termination decision, which involves some what we call burden shifting. So Fred Meyer's going to say, no, she refused to show up, so we fired her for that. It's not a disability reason. And then Livingston comes back and says, well, it is related to my disability because I didn't show up for my shift because you failed to accommodate me. So the reason was really pretext. It was not a non-disability reason. It was, in fact, a disability reason. And then on to the next slide, which is numbered on our webinar 24, although some people may have different numbering. The court reversed the district court's holding that Livingston's refusal was a legitimate reason for firing her. They said her disability prevented her from completing her shift, and she was fired for that reason, so termination related to her disability. Two other cases cited here is the Colwell case, which again found that accommodations to get to work might be required, and that's a recent Third Circuit case. But there were other cases that I found no accommodation duty for committing, and one of them for commuting. One of them was also from the Third Circuit, the Parker versus Verizon case, and a case from the First Circuit, Kevoriak. So the inquiry here for people to vote, should employers be required to accommodate commuting issues? This is more, I think, a policy question than a legal question. If an employee has a commuting issue, should the employer be required to, you know, give them a shift change to make, to facilitate their commuting? So please vote yes or no, and we'll quickly tally those. And let's not always see the same hands. Okay, let's see how we tallied. So this one, it's closer. Of the people responding, 16 said no, and 37 said yes. So that's just a policy question. I don't think there is a right or wrong answer. Next, Gratzel versus Office of the Chief Judges. A picture of Judge Learned Hand there in the upper right-hand corner, just because he has one of my favorite judge looks. In this case, a court reporter was hired for the courthouse control room work, which was not working in a courtroom, but mostly doing typing and transcripts in a separate room. It was ideal for her as she required frequent restroom breaks due to incontinence issues, which resulted from a pregnancy complications. And it worked out fine because other court reporters preferred courtroom court work because you can make extra money typing up transcripts. So as a result, that this job was ideal for her, her employer was not aware of her condition for 5 years. But then for reasons unrelated to the employee, the state decided to say court reporters should rotate through all courtrooms, and they restructured its operations. So her specialist position was eliminated by the state, and everyone was called an official court reporter. No job duties were specified other than everyone would be required to rotate through all the different positions to evenly distribute the workload. Next slide. The employer requested an accommodation of staying in the control room, and the employer refused but offered several alternatives, going to a juvenile courtroom where there are no juries. The employer and the doctor said no to this because they were still far from the restrooms and there was a lack of flexibility. The employer offered to not assign her to rooms where triers were scheduled. The employee didn't want that one either. Or they offered to structure to include only courtrooms with an adjacent restroom and setting up a signal where she can raise her hand and request frequent breaks. And the employee rejected that because it would require a disclosure of her medical condition. The employee stated the only accommodation in the next slide, the employee stated the only accommodation that would work for her would be maintaining the job she had. The employer said that we cannot do that, and as she rejected their three alternatives, she was terminated. So is her request, the issue is her request unreasonable, as it would require elimination of an essential job function? And the court said, yes, she's not a qualified individual. She's unable to fulfill essential functions, which is rotating through the classrooms, and she rejected the reasonable accommodation that the court offered. The court noted that the change was due to legitimate business reasons, not just to get at this employee. Her inability to perform the new essential functions rendered her unqualified. The employer fulfilled their duty to engage in the interactive process and offered her two proposals, which the employee rejected without really a full explanation. And I see that in a lot of cases, I think we all do, where employees turn down accommodations that seem reasonable on their face. Courts are often going to say the employer made an offer. They don't have to give you the accommodation you want. They just have to give one that's effective. And sometimes that's why it behooves employees to even try and offer accommodation if it's not preferred, just to see if it works. Next slide, just some quotes from the court. The court presumes that an employer's understanding of the essential functions of the job is correct unless the plaintiff offers sufficient evidence to the contrary. An employer may specify multiple essential duties. When an employee is expected to rotate through duties, she must perform enough of these duties to enable a judgment she can perform the essential functions. And it's indisputable in this case that in-court reporting became a necessary function with the change that occurred. And the fact that she was qualified for her previous job did not make her qualified for the new job, and by resigning, the employee terminated the interactive process. Next slide. And again, the court keys on her refusal, saying her refusal to consider any accommodation requiring in-court reporting strongly suggests she believes she was incapable of performing this function, therefore she's not qualified. Employers do not have to maintain existing positions that are no longer appropriate if it's based on legitimate business reasons. And even though the employer at this time, in this case, after the change, still allowed temporary assignments to the control room, but they had no duty to make that permanent. They allowed temporary assignments for pregnancy or injury recovery. The employee said, but there's no hardship if I just worked in the control room, and the court held that that's not really relevant. If you're asking for elimination of an essential function, the reasonableness or undue hardship of that request is not relevant. Asking to have an essential function eliminated is never reasonable under the ADA. An employer is not required to create or recreate a new position regardless of the hardship involved. So my question very quickly, should the employee have tried one of the offered accommodations? Let's see a quick yes or no for this one. Oh, good. People are getting quick at voting. Oh, it looks like I don't even have to do the tally. Everyone said yes. And I think so, too. If you try it and it doesn't work, then you have evidence that it's not effective. If you try it and it does work, even though not ideal, at least you found an accommodation that works. So I think either way, it gives the employee some evidence as to their position. So everyone wins on that one. Nice job. And then the next slide, the last case I'm going to discuss before turning it over to Barry is Sawatka versus Rockwell Automation. This kind of involves a more technical legal issues, so I'm not going to go into much depth on this involving mixed motive findings. In this case, Sawatka alleged she was discharged and she was regarded as being disabled even though she could perform the job. And it went to a jury verdict in her favor. And the jury answered yes to the question, did the defendant terminate plaintiff due to its perception that she was substantially limited in her ability to walk or stand? The jury said yes. And they also said yes to a question that said, would the defendant have discharged plaintiff if it did not believe she was substantially limited in her ability to walk or stand and everything else remained the same? So the jury is kind of saying yes, that her disability played a role in the termination, and yes, they would have terminated her even if she did not have a disability. And that's what's called a mixed motive. There's permissible reasons to terminate someone, performance issues, restructuring, and impermissible reasons like disability. In the mixed motive, they're kind of combined. There's permissible and impermissible reasons. So the issue here is whether the jury's mixed motive finding entitles Sawatka to judgment in her favor. And the next slide talks about mixed motive, and this is a little background. And as I said, it's when an employee alleges that he suffered an adverse employment action because of both permissible and impermissible considerations. And there's a couple of Supreme Court cases cited there, Price Waterhouse v. Hopkins and Gross v. FBL Financial. Price Waterhouse is a Title VII case under the Civil Rights Act, and it said that even if the proscribed criterion in Title VII, race, religion, ethnicity, was not the sole reason for the decision. If it played a role, it's still a violation, even if the employer might have done it anyway. And then the Supreme Court had another case after Price v. Waterhouse called Gross v. FBL, which was an age discrimination case under the ADEA. And it noted that the Age Discrimination in Employment Act does not authorize a mixed motive claim. It must be but for. Age must be the termination must have happened only because of age. That must have been the but for cause for the employer's adverse decision. And the court said what Congress is trying to do is to strike a balance between eliminating invidious employment discrimination and preserving the employer's prerogative to employ whoever it wishes and kind of to fire whoever it wishes. So Price Waterhouse allowing mixed motive was codified for the Civil Rights Act, but only for limited relief. And that's listed there. You can get attorney's fees and costs, injunctive relief, but not damages, not reinstatement, not promotions. And the ADA references certain remedies from Title VII, including the mixed motive provision, but it doesn't remedy the liability section from Title VII, and that's the ADA. The ADEA from the Gross case didn't reference Title VII at all for mixed motive. So in Gross, it's clear that the ADEA did not really authorize mixed motive, but the ADA, which references some parts of Title VII, the issue here is did it incorporate mixed motive. And the court said, although it referenced the remedy section of Title VII, it did not reference the liability section for mixed motive employment decisions. And in the next slide, they said, for this reason, there is no mixed motive liability under the ADA for the Seventh Circuit. This is the First Circuit Court to look at it, and the Seventh Circuit overruled its prior cases holding that you could have mixed motive claims under the ADA. An employee must show that the employer would not have fired him but for his disability. Proof of mixed motives would not suffice. And so Watka did not show this, and therefore the jury verdict in his favor was overturned. And it's interesting, the appellate court decision didn't talk about the facts much, but I looked at the district court decision, and it seemed like Rockwell did not engage in the reactive process. They said, oh, we fired him for an economic downsizing, which the court found to be false. So there was something going on there, definitely. Now, one remaining question, the ADA Amendments Act made some statutory changes to make discrimination being on the basis of disability rather than because of. And the Seventh Circuit said, oh, would this change under the ADA Amendments Act? Would we have a different decision if this case was under the ADA Amendments Act? And they wouldn't answer that question, so we'll have to wait and see. So this is the first appellate court post-Gross to look at this issue. I referenced another webinar there on disparate treatment and impact claims. And there's a note that a bill to overturn Gross v. FBL, the Supreme Court case, was introduced in Congress in 2009 and referred to committee last year. I have a query there, but I think we're going to skip this one so I can give Barry enough time to go on. The query is but-for cause the same as being the sole cause? And I don't think it is. I think but-for means, you know, maybe there were other reasons that factored, but the disability was the reason, kind of the final or the straw that broke the camel's back. That's probably a disability inappropriate analogy. But I think for but-for, you can still have multiple causes, but this has to be the major one. It doesn't necessarily have to be the sole and only cause. So with that, we'll start Title II. I'm thinking we'll probably save questions till the end, but I'll leave that up to Barry, and I'll turn it over now to Barry Taylor.
Thanks, Alan. Why don't we give people just a few minutes to, if they have any sort of burning quick questions that you have on their cases that Alan has talked about. Claudia, if you could open up the chat box so people could type in the questions. We'll take a few minutes for that, and then we may need to close off the questions before we get to them all, just so we can get to the other cases.
Okay, I open the chat area. So if you have any questions or comments that you would like to share with Barry and Alan, go ahead and enter that in the chat area at this time. Thank you. And I see a couple of people writing here, so let's do them a second to get their thoughts and take their comments, please. So, Barry, you want to take the first question?
I think this is directed to Alan. It's about the Horgan case you talked about.
Okay. Okay, oh, I'm sorry. I had a different setting, so I wasn't seeing the questions. Did Iqbal come up in Horgan? No, it didn't. And Iqbal involves pleading standards and what has to be alleged regarding a claim. And really, I don't recall it being referenced there. I'll double check, but I think I remember looking for it and not seeing it referenced in there. It was really more a straightforward, did they have a disability issue under the Amendments Act?
And then the next question I'll answer, and then Alan can read the third question. Angela asks whether or not a company can refuse to hire an individual based on lack of hair in a case of hair drug test, or must they find alternative methods such as fingernail testing? I haven't seen cases like that. Alan can advise if he has, but it would seem to me that that they would need to accommodate people who don't have hair, especially if it's based on, you know, disability, like a person who has cancer who doesn't have hair because of their disability. They would need to find an alternative way to do the drug testing.
Yeah, and I'm not sure about that either. I think they would have to find an alternative way, but you know, there are, as long as something is not prohibited by statute, I think you can have a policy of not hiring people without hair. And Barry, someone correct me if you feel otherwise, I think it'd be a silly policy. But I think they'd have to find an alternative means in this case.
Right. Again, unless that was related to some sort of protected class, and that you could argue that, at least for cancer purposes, that would be related to the person's disability. And then Lisa asked a question about epilepsy, and the premise of your question, I think, is actually one that we don't even need to worry about anymore, given the ADA Amendments Act. I think epilepsy in most cases are going to be found to be a disability because generally epilepsy will be found to have a substantial limitation in the major bodily function of the neurological system. And so generally I think people with epilepsy are going to be able to be found to have a disability, and how that fits vis-a-vis ADA paratransit, I mean, they have to not just show they have a disability, but also show that there are barriers that are facing them in using mainline. So for paratransit purposes, you'd have to find something beyond just an ADA disability, but also look at the actual transit barriers that are in existence.
And also, I just did a quick check. Iqbal was not mentioned in Horgan. So.
All right. Well, doesn't look like we have any questions now. Why don't we move to Title II and Title III, and then if you have any questions on any of the titles, just go ahead and do that. Great. And Alan, if you could turn off your microphone, I'm getting a little bit of feedback. Thank you. So everybody, I think, probably knows that Title II covers state and local governments, and as Alan mentioned at the beginning, there's less litigation on Title II and Title III than there is Title I, but there were some significant cases that we wanted to highlight, and so we've got two for Title II and two for Title III. The first Title II case is a case called Frame versus City of Arlington, and one reason we selected this as a for our top 10 list is because the Fifth Circuit has gone in a direction different from all other circuits that have looked at the issue as to the issue of accessibility of sidewalks and state and local government responsibilities. And I think any time one circuit does something different, it's something we should pay attention to because, first of all, it's going a different way, but also when we do have a split in the circuits, that sometimes indicates it may be a case that the Supreme Court may look at or an issue the Supreme Court may look at in the future. So sort of a crystal ball, perhaps this is an issue the Supreme Court may look at now that we have circuit courts differing on the issue of sidewalk accessibility. So this case involved some residents of the city of Arlington who use wheelchairs, and they claimed that the city was failing to make their curbs with no curb cut sidewalks and certain parking lots accessible. And in their complaint, they actually cited 100 different examples of inaccessibility. So they sued under Title II of the ADA. They also sued under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act because the city of Arlington receives federal funds. And this case is a little bit confusing because you might have heard about this case previously because the court ruled before the August decision that we're listing here, they ruled previously on a statute of limitations basis and issued sort of a controversial ruling at that time saying that in determining when the statute of limitation for sidewalk accessibility should be calculated, you look at when the sidewalks were constructed, not when the person with a disability encountered the inaccessibility. For whatever reason, they decided to withdraw that opinion and issue a new decision, which I think is equally controversial and raises some real questions. So instead of looking deciding it on statute of limitation grounds, the court was looking as to whether or not sidewalks are considered services, programs, or activities under Title II of the ADA. And at the bottom of this slide, you'll see that we list the ADA reference to Title II. It says, no individual with a qualifying disability by reason of such disability shall be excluded from participation in or denied the benefits of state and or city provided services, programs, or activities. So that's where the phrase services, programs, or activities comes up. So the question here was, is sidewalks and curbs and parking lots in and of themselves fall within under Title II as a service, program, or activity? So on the next slide, you'll see what the court decided. They said that no, sidewalks, curbs, and parking lots are not Title II services, programs, or activities, but instead are part of the infrastructure that provides access to service programs or activities. They talked about that these sidewalks and curbs and parking lots are like gateways to activities, but in and of themselves aren't necessarily covered by Title II, giving rise to a private cause of action. They said that the sidewalk must connect to some sort of state and local government service program or activity, and that the inaccessibility of a sidewalk is not by itself a violation of the ADA, because not by itself is it a service program or activity. And the plaintiffs in their in the case did connect some of the inaccessible sidewalks to denial of access of other services, like access to schools and access to parks and access to polling places. But they identified a lot of other sidewalks and curb cuts that weren't necessarily directly connected to a state or local government service. And that's where the court was saying that there was no specific cause of action here. And again, they said because it was the sidewalks are really only a gateway to these services, activities, and programs, and not covered by themselves. The court did clarify the statute of limitations issues and said that the statute of limitations is triggered when the plaintiff knows or should have known that there's some sort of barrier there that they got and that they encountered, and that the burden of proof is on the defendant to show the noncompliance with the statute of limitation. But basically, I want to move on to the next slide, which is really where the court starts getting in its analysis. And that they said we need to look at the plain meaning of the word service. And they looked at the dictionary, and they said that in looking at the definition of service, it includes the duties, work, or business performed or discharged by a public official and the provision, organization, or apparatus for meeting a general demand. And the court said, you know, when you look at this definition, sidewalk really isn't a service. They said when a public entity provides or maintains a sidewalk or its accompany curbs or parking lots, it arguably creates an apparatus for meeting a general demand, but it doesn't perform work by a public official. And it really is just saying that this is really infrastructure. It's inanimate. It's not a service itself. And so while an infrastructure may aid in the provision of other services, since it's not a service itself, it's not covered by Title II. In the next slide, we have a couple of slides from the dissent, and we usually don't talk a lot about the dissent, but because the dissent is making the argument that really was made in all the other circuit court decisions that found that sidewalk accessibility is covered by Title II, we wanted you to be aware of the counter-arguments. The court first said that the majority was a little disingenuous because the last previous opinion they had, they used a different definition of service to meet their decision goal. But they said under either definition that you look at in the dictionary, constructing and maintaining sidewalks should be considered a service of a public entity. And at that point, they showed all the other circuit courts that had found the other way. They talked about other circuit courts have consistently held that coverage under service program activities is unambiguous, should be broadly construed. And they criticized the majority for not looking at those in depth of those other circuit court decisions and just relegating them really to a footnote and not having much analysis of the other decisions and offering really no case law to support its analysis that sidewalk accessibility isn't covered by the ADA. And then the dissent goes on to say that given the clear intent of Congress, the fact that they have no precedent is really troubling. And I think what I think is really interesting in the dissent is they think that the majority really asked the wrong question. The question shouldn't be whether the sidewalks themselves that we should be concerned about. It's whether the construction, modification, or alteration of a sidewalk is a service. And they go on to say that the city built the sidewalks, they maintain them, they alter them when necessary, and each of these acts is a normal function of government, and that the actions taken by the city with regard to its sidewalks fall within the service program and activities of Title II. The judge also looks at the legislative history, which basically said that Title II covers really all activities of state and local governments, and constructing and maintaining sidewalks is an activity of state and local governments. So we have another one of those polls where we want to get your view on this and whether you agree with the majority that sidewalk accessibility shouldn't be covered by the ADA. You would vote yes and either click the green check or do control one. If you disagree and think that sidewalks should be covered by the ADA, that state and local governments have responsibility to maintain and construct accessible sidewalks, then you should vote no and click the X or control two. So here we go. And with the calculation, it looks like everybody is in agreement with the dissent almost. We have 52 of those of you who voted said that it sidewalks should be covered by the ADA, and only 3 of you said that it should not be covered by the ADA. And, you know, that was my conclusion as well. You know, if the majority opinion is correct, it would seem to lead to sort of an absurd result that Title II entities would only have to have accessible sidewalks for those that are actually connected to some other government program or service or activity, and then those that are just sort of elsewhere in the state and local government's area wouldn't necessarily be covered by the ADA. So it would be, you know, provide some inconsistent results as well. And then on this slide, you'll see that we have several of the other circuit courts that were referenced in the dissent that found the other way. The Barton case is probably the most well-known because it was one that the Supreme Court considered taking, but at the time, because there wasn't a split in the circuits, they ultimately did not rule in this case. But in that case, the Ninth Circuit said that because a sidewalk can be characterized as a normal function of a government entity, they should fall within Title II. And the Sixth Circuit said something similar, saying that services, programs, and activities really encompass everything a public entity does. The Third Circuit in the Yeske case basically said the same thing. You might remember the Yeske case ultimately ended up at the Supreme Court, and in a unanimous opinion, they found that prisons were covered by Title II of the ADA, and they used, again, that broad language about the coverage of Title II. And then there's also a Second Circuit case, the Innovative Health Systems case, which also said that the service, programs, and activities phrase is really a catch-all phrase that should prohibit all discrimination by a public entity. So we've got a new decision that may affect how this gets viewed by other courts or ultimately by the Supreme Court. And those of you who are in the Fifth Circuit, that would be Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana. At least as of now, you're bound by this decision, and you know, potentially it could be applied beyond the facts of this case. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. We did look, and it did not appear that the losing party, the plaintiffs here, asked for the Supreme Court to review the case. So it appears that this is good law in the Fifth Circuit. The other Title II issue we wanted to address is the issue of community integration under the ADA. I imagine most of you are familiar with the Olmstead decision from 1999, where the Supreme Court said that unjustified institutionalization is a form of discrimination under Title II of the ADA. And there are a variety of Olmstead decisions from the past year, but we decided to focus primarily on Williams versus Quinn, which is a case out of here in Illinois. And full disclosure, Equip for Quality is one of the counsel in that case, along with the ACLU of Illinois, Access Living, Kirkland & Ellis, and the Bazelon Center of Mental Health Law. But I think it's a good case to talk about because it maybe is a different twist on the typical Olmstead decision. This was a case on behalf of people with mental illness who were living in large, privately owned, but state-funded facilities. And in Illinois, those are called Institutions for Mental Disease, or IMDs. And the case, even though the facilities are privately owned, because they're state-funded, the defendants in the case were state officials. Suit was not brought against the facilities themselves. And after extensive discovery, an agreement was reached between the state and the plaintiffs. And because it was a class action, we had to go through a notice period and then a fairness hearing. And ultimately, the judge, despite some objections that were made by family members and people who supported the facilities, the judge ultimately gave final approval to the agreement that the plaintiffs and the state had reached. And that was entered at the end of September. And since then, an independent monitor has been appointed, and the implementation is going forward. And the agreement is really comprehensive. And if you're interested in seeing more about this case and looking at this agreement, it's on the Equip for Equality website, which is www.equipforequality.org. And real quickly, the agreement says that over a 5-year period, any residents of the IMDs, which is about 4,500 people, any resident who desires community placement, once evaluated, shall transition to the most integrated community-based setting. with the default being permanent supportive housing. And there's a lot of great language, I think, in the agreement that talks about that the placement should be person-centered planning and based on the person's needs and desires and wants. And it's real clear in the agreement that if a person doesn't want to move, they don't have to move. The agreement doesn't require anybody to move. People can change their minds. There's no mandatory closure of facilities, although with economic conditions, if enough people choose not to stay in a particular facility, a facility may close based on its own economic evaluation of viability. And oftentimes in these Olmstead cases, one of the main defenses that comes up is the fundamental alteration defense, saying that it would be a fundamental alteration to provide the relief that the plaintiffs are seeking. And here, that was not a strong argument the state could make because the IMDs are 100% state funded. The federal government does not support these facilities. But the community services that are part of the agreement can be funded by the federal government. And so the state will actually be getting an infusion of federal funds to support community integration relief here that's provided to people with mental illness. And so in these tough economic times, this is a case where states are actually getting some new money that they weren't getting already by providing services in a more integrated setting. Next slide. As far as the significance of the case, I think there are a couple things to note. One is that you'll remember the Olmstead decision involved people who were living in state-operated facilities, where the state ran the facility. But more and more states are moving to facilities that are privately owned but state-funded. And so this is a case that makes clear that privately owned facilities that receive state funding are still covered by Title II. And sometimes in these cases, there are arguments that are made, well, these are different than, you know, those state-operated facilities that are on big campuses and are very segregated. Oftentimes, these privately owned facilities are located in neighborhoods. But there was still strong evidence that was put in this case by the experts that despite the fact that they were located in neighborhoods, they were oftentimes very isolated for the residents as far as being in large facilities. They were oftentimes were restrictions on liberty and independence and personal choice. And so they were institutions that would be covered under Title II, even though they weren't necessarily located on a separate campus. We also think it's a significant agreement because we had a similar agreement that was not approved by a judge involving people with disabilities in Illinois with developmental disabilities. And when a similar agreement came before the judge last year, there was a question on whether or not this judge would approve the agreement or not, and he did approve it. And interestingly, after that approval, a new agreement was reached in the developmental disability case, the Ligas case, and was recently presented to the judge and is now going through the fairness hearing process again, and we'll have a fairness hearing in June. So potentially we'll have a second agreement in Illinois providing community integration for people with disabilities. And I think it's also significant because most of the cases that we talk about in these webinars are cases where you have court decisions. And while the court did make a decision and you have a written opinion, it was a decision upholding an agreement that was reached by the parties. And I think oftentimes that's the best resolution of the case. When you do take a case to judgment, sometimes the remedy you get in that isn't necessarily as detailed or as tailored to what your goals are for the goals of your clients than if you actually have an agreement that you sit down and spend a lot of time with the opposing party working out. And I feel like in the Williams case, we were actually able to spend a lot of time to work out a very comprehensive and detailed agreement that will really work well for people with disabilities and work well for the state. So just another reason why we think this is an important case to talk about. You should know there's another case with very similar facts out of New York where they actually did have a decision, but that case was appealed up to the Third Circuit. And the briefs were filed last year, 2010, and oral argument, and we should have a decision in 2011. So it'll be interesting to see if the Third Circuit ends up upholding the lower court's decision, which was very similar to the agreement that was reached in in the Williams case. The other thing that's significant about this case is that the court laid out exactly what it views as we often term an Olmstead plan. You might remember in the Olmstead decision, the Supreme Court said that people with the state can show that it meets its obligations under the ADA in an Olmstead case if it has a comprehensive, effectively working plan. And you'll see the four factors that the court found that need to be in place to have an Olmstead plan and that they found New York did not have, and that is a very clear time frame and target dates for placement of people in the community, an approximate number of people to be placed within a particular time period, eligibility for placement, and then a description of the collaboration of different authorities and agencies to effectuate successful integration in the community. So I think the Patterson case is a great case to look at as far as what states should be putting forward in their Olmstead plans. And then the next slide, we have just another community integration case that I'm actually not going to go into detail because of our time. But this is a case involving the reason we brought this up is this raises the issue of people who aren't actually in an institution right now, but are at risk of being in an institution because of actions by the state. In this case, cutting some funding for home health care, and the plaintiff was at risk of moving in an institution, and the court found that he was covered under the ADA and issued an injunction that allowed him to continue to receive services in the home. You should note that that case was a district court decision and is currently on appeal before the Fifth Circuit, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. In the Fifth Circuit, we've had some positive decisions here in Illinois on similar issues and have good precedent that hopefully, from a disability standpoint, will work out for the plaintiff in this case as well. So let's move to Title III. We're going to focus on two cases under Title III. Remember, Title III again is, Title III is public accommodations, private businesses that are open to the public. And the first case we want to talk about is a case you might have seen that got a lot of press involving movie theater access. And this was a case involving people who wanted to go to the movies with disabilities who were either deaf and hard of hearing or who were blind and had low vision. And they were seeking, the people who were deaf and hard of hearing were seeking captioning, and the people who were blind or had low vision were seeking audio descriptions. And the case really came down to the question of whether or not public accommodations, movie theaters, are required to provide auxiliary aids and services, whether captioning and audio description is an auxiliary aid or service covered under the ADA. And the lower court, the district court decision here, found in favor of the movie theaters and said the ADA does not require movie theaters to provide these types of services, captioning or video description, because it alters the content of the services. And so this was appealed up, in the next slide you'll see, to the Ninth Circuit, and we had a decision in 2010 that reversed and said that closed captioning and audio descriptions are auxiliary aids and services that may be required unless you can show some sort of undue burden or fundamental alteration like we talked about before. So what they did was they said these are the types of things Congress intended and the Department of Justice intended to be considered auxiliary aids and services. We're going to send it back down to the district court to figure out if providing those services would somehow be an undue burden or a fundamental alteration. But in and of themselves, they are auxiliary aids and services. And the next two slides just kind of explain what we're talking about with respect to closed captioning and audio description. You can go through those yourself if you're not familiar with those. But one thing to note is that when they issued their ruling, the Ninth Circuit said that they were saying that closed captioning and audio descriptions are auxiliary aids and services. But based on Department of Justice regulations, they said that that open captioning was not necessarily required under the ADA. So moving on two slides, you'll see the analysis of the court. And they said, they just were explaining why it is an auxiliary aid, and they cited to the ADA and showed in the definition of auxiliary aids and services that first qualified interpreters or other effective means for people with hearing impairments are auxiliary aids and services. And so other effective means, the court said, would include closed captioning. And then similarly, the next part of the definition of auxiliary aids and services said qualified readers, taped texts, or other effective means or methods of making visually delivered materials available to people with visual impairments, that would include the descriptive narration. And so they said that, that both closed captioning and descriptive narration fit clearly within the definition of auxiliary aids and services. Next slide. And then they go into a little bit more detail and cite some of the specific regulations that talk about this issue. It gets a little confusing because it gives us examples, open and closed captioning and audio recordings, as examples of auxiliary aids and services. And what the court ultimately said is even though the Department of Justice listed open captioning as an example, it doesn't mean that it's required. And the preamble that said that open captioning wasn't required under the ADA really took precedent in this particular case. The district court seemed to say that that providing captioning or audio description would constitute a different service that eliminates the duty to provide those types of aids, and you're not required to provide a different service. And the court said, you know, that makes no sense at all because by its own definition, an auxiliary aid or service is an additional or different service that an establishment must offer. So they really disagreed with the lower court's analysis here. And so this slide talks about the open captioning that I referenced before, the preamble saying that open captioning is not required, and then other regulations that talk about an example of open captioning as an example of an auxiliary aid. And the court said that there's an apparent conflict here. They think the preamble saying that it's not required would take precedence. They also looked at some legislative history that said that as technology advances, the requirements may change. And that's actually a good segue to another reference on this slide, and that is that the Department of Justice is currently accepting comments on a variety of issues, including captioning, open and closed captioning, with respect to its regulations. And if you are interested in giving your input on whether or not closed or open captioning should be something that movie theaters be required to provide, you still have time to do so. They are taking comments through Monday, January 24th, and there's a link there that you can go to provide your comments on this issue or a variety of other issues that they're looking at. And we also did a previous webinar on other issues involving movie theater access, including physical access and companion seating. So if you're interested in more movie theater access issues, you can go to the Great Lakes website and look in the archives for our Title III litigation webinar, and that has some of those cases listed there. As far as on other movie theater cases, the state of Massachusetts recently reached an agreement with three different movie theater chains. If you're interested in looking at that agreement, it's on the state of Massachusetts website. I just Googled state of Massachusetts Attorney General movie theaters, and the settlement agreement comes right up in a press release. So that requires all movie theaters within these three chains to have one accessible movie theater that has captioning and audio description, and it also, if it's a larger theater grouping that has 10 or more, then they have to have at least two accessible, and the largest theater within that 10 grouping would have to be one of those that is accessible. So that's one agreement that was reached. A number of attorney generals have filed litigation or reached agreements with states across the country. I know New Jersey and New York have been involved in these as well. Here in Illinois, we have filed a similar complaint with our attorney general, and we're hopeful that we'll get a good agreement in Illinois to enhance movie theater accessibility as well. And then most recently, there was new litigation that was filed in California by the disability rights advocates on behalf of deaf and hard of hearing patrons to provide access there. So this continues, and I think watching the litigation as well as the Department of Justice regulations will be helpful here. And then the last issue I'm going to focus on is direct threat in the context of public accommodations. And typically when we think about direct threat, it usually comes up in the employment context, but this is an example of a case where direct threat has come up in the context of public accommodations. So we wanted to raise this case for that issue. We also wanted to raise it because it shows that HIV discrimination is still something that's happening in 2010, so it's not an issue that's gone away. So this case has You know, some people may think we picked it because it has a funny title, Doe versus Deer, and it, you know, brings images of Julie Andrews singing in The Sound of Music, and Alan's put a picture of Julie Andrews singing the Do Re Mi song there. But actually, we picked it because we think it is significant because of the title Three Direct Threat Analysis, as well as the HIV discrimination. It involved a camp that had an applicant for basketball camp, a 10-year-old applicant with HIV, and ultimately they decided he could not come, finding that they thought he was a direct threat. A nurse who did the analysis of his application had concerns that he would pass on his HIV through the pool or through using the same toilet as other campers. And the court said that, you know, the decision that they made here was a violation of the ADA, that they were basing the decision to bar him from the camp really only on his HIV status, and they did not meet the direct threat standard of showing that he was a significant risk of substantial harm, that they failed to present any evidence that would show that they relied upon any current objective medical evidence as to how HIV was transmitted, that there wasn't a real basis for denying him from this camp, therefore a direct threat defense would not be viable. I think one really important component of this is that the nurse said, you know, this was a good faith belief. I thought what I was doing was the right thing. And the court said a good faith belief alone is insufficient. When we're talking about direct threat, it really has to be based on objective medical evidence, and they did not obtain that in this case. Just because of time, I won't go into the details of the investigation of the case, but I think the main thing to get here is that the court talked about how important it is to do an individualized assessment, looking at the particular individual and whether that person is a direct threat, and that even though the court doesn't independently assess whether the plaintiff poses a direct threat, it does look at the reasonableness of the defendant's actions, and they found here that the defendant was not reasonable in its actions, and that they did not meet the two-part test of showing that it's a significant risk of substantial harm. And that they did not find any current medical knowledge or objective evidence to support their decision that he was a direct threat. And without presenting that evidence, they couldn't survive summary judgment. and ultimately, because the defendant didn't provide any objective evidence, the court on its own looked at things like the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes of Health, that basically showed that HIV can't survive. It's a very weak virus when it hits air, and it can't survive outside the body, and so these concerns about HIV transmission in the pool or in toilet seats was really not warranted. And then we just have a few other direct threat cases that are more traditional employment cases that we think were interesting, and you might want to review in more detail. The first one is one where they found that the person did not meet, that the employer did not meet the direct threat burden because they didn't do an individualized assessment. This was a gentleman who tested positive for methadone because he was in drug rehab, and the doctor who decided he was a direct threat based that on not assessing this person individually or talking to his doctor, but instead based on, you know, his perceptions of methadone and the side effects it would have. And then the Mays case, also on this slide, went the other way and was a case where somebody was had severe epilepsy seizures and was actually injured themselves and other people, and the court there found that you know, it was clear evidence that the person was a direct threat because of them hurting themselves and others, and that it wasn't required to do an independent medical examination, that the unpredictability and frequency of the seizures and the impact of it injuring employees was sufficient to, and injuring the plaintiff himself, herself, was sufficient to uphold a direct threat analysis. And in the Wurzel case, the reason we wanted to bring that up is that here you had somebody with a heart ailment who was having significant episodes in the workplace but hadn't actually injured himself or other people. And the court said that you don't have to wait until actual harm occurs. As long as you can show that it's likely that there would be harm, that's enough for a direct threat. And here the court found that the employer had showed there was likely harm and that he was in an employment situation near machinery and in an isolated environment at Heights, where it could have been if he continued to have these episodes, he would likely hurt himself or other people in the workplace, and so therefore they can move forward with their direct threat defense. So we have, Claudia, why don't you open up the chat box and people can type in their questions, and I'll just go through these last few slides about some resources. On this slide, we talk about some different resources that are available, the National Network of ADA Centers. The EEOC has a lot of information on Title I, DOJ, a lot of information on Titles II and III. You're welcome to contact Equip for Quality, and you're also welcome to contact the Job Accommodation Network, which has a lot of information on Title I issues and accommodating employees. Just a reminder that this session is, if you are an Illinois attorney, you can get 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit because Equip for Quality is a certified provider in Illinois. All you have to do is email me, and then I will send you the forms that you need to fill out, and that email address again is barryt@equipforequality.org. And just a reminder that our next session is going to be on March 16th, and we're going to be going over the issues of the ADA and post-secondary education and licensing testing issues, which has been coming up a lot more frequently, and we want to give you an update on the most recent cases in that arena. So let's see the questions. As far as CLE for other states, we really only at this point have CLE for Illinois. I know that Robin Jones, head of Great Lakes, is looking at trying to expand CLE beyond Illinois, but at this point I think it's only limited to Illinois. We'll let you know if that changes.
Yeah, that's correct. Right now we're only doing Illinois.
And I also wanted to point out Ken Sciottani from the National Disability Rights Network gave a really helpful correction that there is a petition for a rehearing en banc in Frame. So when I said that it hadn't been petitioned for the Supreme Court, the reason is they're actually trying to get the Fifth Circuit to relook at this. And Ken informs us that the Department of Justice has submitted a brief in support of the petition for a rehearing en banc. So thanks for that correction, Ken. So we should watch what happens. As for those of you who aren't familiar with petitions for rehearing en banc, those are discretionary with the court. They don't have to take it. It's a voting of all the different circuit court judges, and if a certain number say yes, then they will rehear it again and potentially could overturn that decision that we talked about before. Looks like we have about 3 more minutes. Any final questions, or Alan, if you have any comments about anything that I didn't cover correctly or additions you want to make, feel free to jump in. There are a couple of other slides. Let me just make sure I pass on as far as the evaluation. You'll see that there's that this session is archived and will be available in 2 business days at the link that's there, and that a survey will be sent to you by email, and we really appreciate if you fill that out and give us any feedback. That will help us as we evaluate future sessions. Alan, any final comments?
I don't really have final comments. I was wondering about people's feedback, because this was different than our other presentations, and then we picked a select number of cases and looked at them in depth. So just wondering how people liked that type of format as opposed to the issue-specific format.
And you can see people are applauding. So they're applauding, putting happy faces and green check marks. So they like this approach. Lots of applause coming up.
Okay. Looks like there's a question for you, Claudia. It says, how can we get a certificate of participation in the webinar? How should they go about doing that?
Okay. If you can just send an email of response to the one that sent out the reminder to adaconferences@adagreatlakes.org, requesting a certificate of attendance for this session, and then what we'll go through is we'll do verification of your participation, and once you meet the criteria of participating at least for 80% of the session, we will send that certificate to you. So please send an email to adaconferences@adagreatlakes.org.
Great, thanks. And it looks like Angela was asking about whether there are other cities that have decided that curb cuts aren't and access to sidewalks aren't required in the ADA. And certainly there were some, you know, the Barden case and some other cases that were cited where they've made that argument but have not been successful. I think there's one district court New Jersey case that has gone the other way, but no other circuit court cases that I'm aware of that have gone the same way as Frame.
Yeah, it was interesting how the court in Frame said, oh, we realize all the other circuit courts went the other way, but we don't think they did a good analysis. We're the ones who are right. A little bit of hubris, I thought, from the court.
And then they didn't do much analysis at all after they said that. So very interesting. And we should definitely watch the petition for a rehearing on that. And it looks like Angela's got some problems in Niagara Falls, so perhaps some litigation may be arising there as well. But again, generally, the most courts aren't supported that Title II does cover it. So I think it's if you're negotiating or trying to advocate, I think highlighting those cases as the majority opinion certainly is a good approach. And I think Niagara Falls, I don't know if it falls within one of the circuits of the cases that we mentioned. I think we had a second and third circuit, so you might want to check that and see if there's good precedent you can rely upon there.
Yeah, and this sort of seems to make sense that creating, constructing, maintaining sidewalks is a service, not a facility. It just seems much more logical.
Great. Well, it looks like we are at the bottom of the hour and our time is up. So if people have any additional questions, you've got my email. I'll be happy to answer them, or I'll work with Alan to answer them. And hope you join us in March for the session we have on post-secondary education and licensing issues. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for participating. Thank you, Alan and Barry. This was a great session. It was full of a lot of information. And as Barry said, he posted his email. It's barryc@equipforequality.org. If you want to follow up with any of these cases, or if you need other technical assistance, you can call the Great Lakes ADA Center at 877-949-4232. So, and I just want to remind everybody that we did record this session, and we will be posting the archive of the recording along with the materials within 2 business days on our site. That's ada-audio.org. And you would just click on the legal webinar section, and you can see the schedule, the archives, and register for other sessions as well. Please keep an eye out for an email that's going to provide the evaluation link. We'd like you to provide any information or comments on this session so we can continue to improve and keep extending the session. Any suggestions on topics, feel free to send that as well. So thank you, Mary and Ellen, and this concludes our session. So to exit, please click on the exit at the right-hand corner of the session, and have a good afternoon.